I would like to start by acknowledging with gratitude that we are meeting, most of us electronically, but on the traditional lands of the Coast Salish people, and in particular, the Qualicum First Nation. We'll start with adoption of the agenda. We have a mover and a seconder, please. Doug and David? Great. All those in favor? Perfect. And then approval of the minutes. Need a mover and a seconder. Doug? And a seconder, Greg? Any discussion?
I'd just like to say thanks to Bernadette for summarizing all the discussion. It's very helpful for us.
Pleasure.
Well done. And I would like to give actually Bob credit, because it says promote Qualicum Beach high quality tap water, perhaps using the motto Qualicum Beach. It actually should be Qualicum Beach water, always on tap. And that was Bob saying from the water bottles way back at the 75th anniversary. Anyways. So, okay. So we'll vote on the minutes. All those in favor? Great. Approved. Business arising from the minutes. That was on last week, so we're our last meeting, so we're referring back to the discussion on water conservation. Was there anything, any discussion there? Anything anyone wanted to add to that discussion or summarize or jump in? Doug?
Yeah, I just want to say I came away from that discussion very encouraged to think that actually Qualicum Beach seems to be in pretty good condition in terms of water sustainability, sustainability of our freshwater resources in town going forward. And so that's very encouraging. But that started me thinking about the whole climate change adaptation plan and thinking, well, if water is not something that we have to be terribly worried about, what are the big issues that, that we maybe need to be worried about? And I think that one of the possible gaps or in the climate change adaptation plan as it stands is food security. I started thinking about, you know, in the long term, what are the impacts of climate change going to be for our community? And as you realize, Vancouver Island doesn't produce more than a small fraction of the food we consume. And many of the foods we do consume come from sources that will be subject to threats due to climate change, such as agriculture in California and Mexico, for example. And I just wonder whether in our response to the climate change adaptation plan, we should be recommending more attention paid to the issue of food security.
Yeah. Bob, are most of the agricultural lands, are they on their own wells, or are they hooked up to town water?
Most of them are on their own wells. Some get water legally or illegally out of Beach Creek.
Oh.
So Beach Creek runs through some agricultural lands before it crosses like Mann Road or Fern Road, whatever you want to call it. And there's a couple of dead oaks there that the nursery out there takes water, and I think the other agricultural property adjacent to it takes water.
That's
not ideal, but the sort of legacy issues.
Because certainly farming is water intensive.
Yes.
And a lot of those acreages currently aren't being farmed. So I think Doug makes a very good point there going forward.
Yeah. Well, it was, interestingly, it was one of Daniel's initiatives for us trying to get control over the sandpiper wells as part of the bulk water agreement, is although the water might not be ideal for residential consumption, it could always be drafted back to sort of feed the agricultural properties. A little higher and higher than it needs, still probably suitable. So, I mean, even though we're kind of flush with water, he was still, you know, we're sort of thinking about every eventuality and opportunity.
Okay, good. Well, so Bernadette, you've got that down, the food security, right? Do you want to...
Can I just add one little comment, the food security thing there? I mean, yeah, I guess the main thing are actual, you know, properties that are across as farms and fairly large scale production enterprises. But I think going forward, part of food security is just, you know, home gardens and small scale stuff and all that kind of thing too. And, you know, we probably want to be kind of encouraging that or at least not discouraging that by some of the other things we might be considering as we go along here. And, you know, again, that ties back into that tree, potential tree bylaw and all that kind of stuff with light for gardens and whatever. So just something I think we should be, you know, bearing in mind as we're dealing with other topics.
Yeah. Good point. It's not just farms. There's a lot of growing that happens on private, residential properties as well. Bob, did you put up your hand there?
Well, I was just going to say that Luke's planning and building inspection department should remind people that they could probably put a greenhouse structure on their property without a building permit because he has it at 10 square meters.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, well, we'll move on from there. Then we've made a note of food security under the water conservation and just forward thinking and planning in that area. So there was a number of recommendations from council. One was about the urban forest master plan, and that was directed to the committee. However, the note from staff and the recommendation is that it be deferred until the completion of our climate change adaptation plan review. So we'll finish up there before we move on to the next item. And again, with the climate change mitigation and that conversation, that it be deferred until completion, again, of the climate change adaptation plan review. So we have A and B, and we'll keep them on the agenda for future meetings, but we won't get into them today. I think that's the plan. Is that what you're thinking, Luke, as well?
That's right. There's a lot of items on the agenda already, so we'll just deal with them in sequence.
Okay. Great. So then that moves us on to the reviewing the climate change adaptation plan and looking at objective 9, to integrate climate change thinking into future planning. And I talked to Luke a little bit about how we might do this, and I thought maybe just even start with some brainstorming if people have some ideas and we can have a conversation. But maybe I can turn it over to you, Luke, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Thank you, Councilor Skipsy. What I think about when I look at this one is how do we approach climate change adaptation as a long-term endeavor, and how do we kind of integrate it into our systems? So, you know, knowing that we're not going to deal with it in this council term or next council term, and, you know, we're talking about an initiative that's going to span multiple careers and decades. So this one is really about how do we integrate this? How do we turn it into systems that will be maintained over time? So a few of these items are already getting at the types of thinking we need to think about. You know, for example, like engaging youth, exploring opportunities with town staff, you know, for someone to oversee these types of things, sharing public education. So, like Councilor Skipsy said, I think a little bit of a brainstorming is in order. I just wanted to give us some context that whereas the other ones are about specific issues, this is about how do we even think about it? How do we think about such a long-term initiative? So I'll turn it back to you, and let's see where the conversation goes from here.
Okay. So does anybody have anything they want to jump in with? Okay, we got a couple of hands. Maybe we'll start with you, David, and then Karen and Greg.
Yeah, one of the things that occurred to me was, and it's probably become more of an emergent situation since the plan was developed, was the occurrence of the heat dome last summer. And we're looking at over 600 people in the province died because of that heat dome. And looking at our demographics here, I'm wondering if there should be perhaps a real move to work with emergency management and local residents associations to deal with monitoring of people within their homes. It's I read an article in Globe and Mail a week before last, which dealt with the effect of the heat dome. And it, one of the things it pointed out was that cooling centers were all all well and good, but when people go back into their overheated homes after a certain amount of time in the cooling center, you go right back to square one. And that doesn't mean that all things are well, but those folks probably need to be monitored. So I'm wondering community-wide if we should be looking at some kind of preparation for this in the short term, because, I mean, who knows? I mean, we could have, it seems to be unlikely, but it means possible in August of this year that we could have another heat event, or perhaps next year. And it's probably, I would think, should move up in terms of risk, perhaps to a high risk. Anyway, just my thoughts on that.
Yeah. No, I think it has been on people's minds definitely since the event took place last summer. So it's not one of those what ifs now. It's like when kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, Karen.
Am I muted? No,
I'm
not. Okay. So this is such a huge topic, and I know we're all really aware of that. And so some of the things that we want to talk about are probably very specific, like the one that was just mentioned, but there's also a sort of an overarching thing that I wanted to draw attention to, and that is that I've just been reading this report about the Bowker Creek Initiative in Saanich, Victoria, and Hope Bay, where this whole thing started in 2010, and it's been going ever since. We try to daylight the creek and to make people aware of the fact that they live in a watershed and that we can actually plan in terms of infrastructure and development with all of those concerns in mind. And one of the things that stuck with me when I was reading that was this notion of cathedral thinking, which is that you know, way back hundreds of years ago when people were building a cathedral, they realized they were not going to get it built in their lifetime. And so there was a baton passing that went on from generation to generation so that people who were doing something now had the understanding that they might not be able to get something 100% finished in their lifetime, but that didn't mean they shouldn't do something now, and that as the next generation or the next person, even in a job, in a staff position, as the next person comes in and takes over that job, they don't have to start a game trying to understand where the policies are, where the initiatives are, where the energy is. They can step in right away and start doing something because there is this cathedral thinking that it's going to be 100 years. It got us so many years to get to where we are, and it's going to take us so many years to get to where we want to be, so that we don't get bogged down in this notion that we can't do anything, and so that people who are new, who come on, don't have to start at the very beginning each time. So that's one of the things that I would like to introduce into our thinking about adaptation, is that we need to do emergency things, yes, and we need to have priorities, But we also need to understand that there is a, there's a legacy as well.
Yeah, I like that. And I think, you know, sometimes, especially as politicians, we, you know, we think about the term, right? And we need to be thinking about the long term, right? What can we accomplish in the term? And the other day it was about housing. Oh, well, that would take 5 years. Well, so what? You know, 5 years goes by like that, right? So,
right.
I like that point that, you know, we need to be thinking not just this term or, but many terms.
Exactly. Yeah.
Good. Okay. David, do you have a comment on that?
Well, just a second what Karen said. I think that's one of the difficulties, not only in this community, but provincially and federally as well, that we're thinking in short term, 3.5 to at the very best four year terms, and then it's like starting all over again. So there needs to be some kind of agency which is external to that, or a group which is external to that, which can carry that on. As Karen says, pass that baton on to the next group, to the next group, to the next group. So there needs to be a way of sort of circumventing the sort of political reality, shall we say.
Good. Greg. You had your hand up there. You had some.
Yeah, like I said, I have a few comments here too. Yeah, this is an interesting one because it's sort of deals with quite a variety of time frames from the council terms of, you know, 50 or 100 years out. And I guess we sort of have to look at the whole thing and see how we're gonna, you know, move through that time frame. I've got a couple here that I guess I would call them sort of middle-term things. They're not quite as long-term as some of the previous comments, and they're probably a little bit longer than the term of council. So what I was thinking is, you know, there were those priority risks assigned, I think on page 22 or something of the climate adaptation plan, and some of them were, you know, ranked as medium high and medium, whatever. So I was kind of thinking I noticed a couple that jumped out at me. Maybe it's just ones I've been interested in over my time in the committee here. But I was thinking it might be an idea to sort of pick a couple of the higher, you know, ones that are rated as higher risk, and sort of think about if those are things that can be addressed directly by decisions that council makes, rather than some of them are more sort of peripheral or whatever. So I, you know, I look right at the top there and I see the hotter and drier summers increasing the wildfire risk, and then I go down and I see sea level rise and damage to infrastructure and coastal property. Now, in my mind, both of those things are stuff that takes, you know, quite a while to address, 10, 20, 30 years. In terms of the fire stuff, if you're doing landscape level fuel reduction treatments, that's something that, you know, you may start it now, but it's going to be, you are going to be doing it for a long time until you get there. The sea level rise, you know, as we discussed earlier, you've got a certain set of, you know, like a set of maps, you know what's affected if it comes up 1 meter or 2 meters or 3 meters. And you've got, you know, bylaws and zoning and people still building down there and all that kind of stuff. So anyways, I was thinking of sort of a midterm thing to really zero in on a couple of those and just kind of follow it through for 10, 20, 30 years and make sure we're doing the right thing now to get us to where we want to be 20, 30 years out. And we also have to do the other things that were mentioned previously, the longer term stuff and the educating the youth and making sure we can pass on to the next generation a lot. But I think there's also a role to focus on some things that we can start now that'll be ongoing.
Yeah, and I think those ones, like the first, the hotter and drier summers, you don't really need to convince people of that. Like, you know, we've seen all the smoke. We've, you know, been through that experience with all the smoke and then the heat dome. And, you know, people can feel it. They can relate to it. Whereas some of the other things, when it's projected into the future,
it is
harder to sort of get people on board or understanding maybe the severity.
Right. So some of those things, I mean, people understand them, but from my perspective, there's still maybe not too much actually getting done to move us along the path that we might want to be on.
Yeah. Yeah, even though they're longer term, we still need to start now, right?
Yeah,
good point. Does anybody have any comments about that? I haven't really gone back and looked at that list of risks. Thank you for referring to that. And it's interesting, though, that really the only one on this list that was identified in the plan as being a higher risk was that hotter, drier summers. Everything else was kind of medium.
Yeah.
And medium low. So, Bob, do you want to jump in?
If you don't mind, it's just an observation on the three comments that have been made. Like, you know, I really like the concept of cathedral thinking, and because the success of cathedral thinking is that people understand what they want, and they have a vision of delivering the cathedral someday, and that's, you know, it's for us to define what that deliverable is. And like David, I know that like you talked about, you know, in my mind, you're almost discussing another level of governance, and I don't know if we're going to get there. But I think that to have success, you might not need another level of governance if you can demonstrate that your plan is a good one and it is delivering what you want to see. And to Greg's point of the sea level rise of the waterfront, we've got a couple initiatives now where we put the headlands out in front of the beach. We certainly at the Brant viewing area, there's some private properties where they've been established. Brant viewing area ones that the scientists now think that maybe are a little too far. But the idea was they break the energy and you get natural deposition behind them. And then over time, it starts to reestablish your beach materials. But it's nature doing the heavy lifting over time. So if you can demonstrate a couple of these initiatives, you know, they are going to take a long time to stabilize your shoreline, and you're going to have them, you know, you roll them out along the shoreline. But, you know, to that idea of like, you know, maybe on that level of governance, but something that you get people to buy into that your plan is a good one, and we need to continue down this road. And that heads us towards cathedral thinking over time. You know, we continue with the good plan, and councils are, you know, they will be motivated to stick with the plan, follow a good idea, and you've demonstrated that it's financially attainable and it's delivering good results. And that was what was going through my mind when I heard all three of you speak. Anyway, just my thoughts.
Yeah, and to kind of add to that, I think Bob's point is a good one, that you need a clear vision, but people also need to see progress, right? So in other words, we have this vision for the waterfront, but if all we had was a vision and that we promised to deliver in 50 years, well, that wouldn't work, right? So you have to show progress. In other words, if people never saw the cathedral getting any higher, you know, if we never saw walls going up, I think their interest would start to wane pretty quickly. So, yeah, no, I think that it's a good point, and you're all right on the money there. You know, long-term vision, showing progress.
Doug, did you have any comments that you wanted to share?
Yes, sure. Thank you. Well, another example of that sort of long-term thinking, you remember with the vegetation management plan, we put forward the idea of the 30-year right tree, right place strategy, recognizing that we don't have the urban forest we have in Qualicum Beach now is great in some ways, but it's not ideal for the future climate. And but that's not something you can change overnight. So really, I pulled the number 30 years out of thin air, and it might not be the right number, but we know that it would be a multi-decade project unless we were going to, you know, because trees take time to grow and people won't accept large, rapid replacement of trees because that involves cutting trees down, which a lot of people don't like. But we could do exactly what you're saying, show some progress. Like if we have a little bit, even a little, pick one block in town or a small neighborhood in town and say, okay, over the next 3 or 4 years, let's look at the trees we have here. Are they doing what everybody wants? Are the neighbors, are the people living in the neighborhood really happy with the trees? Are they the right trees for the long-term future? And what can we do different? Are there some trees that are problem trees or going to become problem trees? And are there other places that there aren't trees, that there ought to be trees? So that would be one way to do that. And the other thing that really strikes me is the stock of buildings we have, because, you know, that's a very long-term process to turn over the entire stock of buildings in the town. Buildings tend to have 50 to 100 or more year lifespans. So it's very important to start building the buildings now that are the buildings we need for the future. And I have to say, I do find it discouraging to walk from my home into town and see people building buildings with black asphalt roofs, which is the worst roof for climate. That is absolutely the standard. 9 out of 10 houses built in Qualton Beach have that. I'm seeing people build a house with 15-foot ceilings in the living room. Why? You know, we're facing a climate emergency. The scientists are telling us that if we do everything we can to mitigate climate change, there's a possibility that our children and grandchildren will be spared a nightmare future. We're certainly heading for a nightmare future, but it's not too late to avert it. And yet people have money to, you know, cut down forests, to make into 16-foot studs so they can have ceilings twice as tall as they need. You know, it just, I am really, really discouraged with the building I see going on here, which is building for the past, not for the future. And I wonder what can be done to encourage the builders to start building the kind of buildings we need for the future. I know it's a big topic, but, you know, when we talk about what the town has control over, that's one of the big things the town does control is what kind of buildings go up inside the town. So, and that's as much a mitigation one as an adaptation one, but it is also an adaptation one, too. So, anyway, that's two thoughts about that.
Karen, did you have a comment about that or something else?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that as I listen to conversations like this where there's terminology getting bandied about, and there's lots of terminology no matter what you talk about. You know, there's always terms and terms of art and specific things. And I think sometimes because I'm new to all of this, it's easier for me to see this, but a simple thing is making the terminology familiar to people so that when you start talking about, you know, tree management, or you're talking about watersheds, or you're talking about building materials or whatever it is, because all of this stuff is climate stuff, that we use the same terms consistently and we find a way to get people comfortable with them. Because if you, like when I first started reading this stuff about watersheds, some of the terminology was very new to me and I went and looked it up, but I've invested some time in educating myself about this. That happens to be my interest. People who aren't particularly interested still have an impact. And so the easier you can make it for people to understand what you're talking about, the more likely it is that people will pay attention when they read something or hear something. So maybe there's a way through public education and having a little thing in the local paper every so often that introduces a term or introduces a concept or invites people on a walk. Like when we're talking about taking a certain neighborhood, what trees are in this neighborhood, how long will they last, do they serve the neighborhood, what could we be planting now, and in 30 years, what will that look like? We could invite people on a walk through a neighborhood where those things are being discussed, and it might be interesting, more of a hands-on, interesting kind of, I mean, you said brainstorming. This is brainstorming. I mean, that's all this is. This is a thought-out plan I'm offering here. I'm just saying that's where engagement comes from, I think. If people start to feel comfortable with the words and they start to notice the things around them. Oh, in my neighborhood, look how many roofs happen to be black asphalt, you know? Like, people start to notice that, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like when you get a new car and then you look around it and you always see that car, but you never saw that car before.
Yeah, it is like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, it's electric car.
Encourage, yeah, and now I'm noticing electric cars, exactly. So encouraging, finding ways, one of the things we might be thinking about is finding ways to make that noticeable for people and easier for them to think about the things that they're doing, the way they're using water, the trees they're planting, are they growing vegetables, if they're doing a reno, if I want to put in a greenhouse, you know, all that stuff. We could feature a different thing each time or something.
I had a few things on my list, and one of them was about education. You know, and telling stories or making it, yeah, relatable. You and I had talked a little bit, just getting you up to speed a little bit about the committee and how we operate. So that was on my list as well. The other thing, one of the things that I had was about decision making and making it easy for council when we're making decisions that we know the impact on some of these things, like the environment or... I have seen it where other communities have had it on every staff report that comes forward, what the impact is going to be, or, you know, they flag certain areas that they think should be considered in each decision. So, you know, perhaps that part of it is helping council make informed decisions. Of course, there has to be the political will as well. But, and also in the plan, it talks about a staff person, so budgeting for that, right? Putting some money, I guess, towards this, and what is realistic, and what does that look like? We talked a little bit at the beginning about some of the partnerships or maybe an outside agency. I did have that, you know, working together with people from the community or community organizations, that there's lots of different groups out there. But a lot of times the communication doesn't flow so that people aren't always aware what somebody else is undertaking or what initiatives are happening. So it's really important that those groups and that work is somehow connected. The other thing I had was our sustainability action plan, you know, dusting that off. It was a great plan. It was, you know, it really is a good plan. And looking at what those targets were. And what in today's world and today's reality, what are those targets? What are new, you know, what should be trying to achieve or achieving, not even just trying, you know, making sure we achieve certain things. And then to, I think Doug's point about how do we encourage builders, and a lot of the wording in the OCT or in different documents talk about what we should be doing or could be doing, and I think that some of that has had limited effectiveness. So either we're not giving that message clearly or it's not being heard, and maybe some of those should have to turn to must, you know, like what are those requirements in the areas that was mentioned, that where the town does have some control. The other thing I had is valuing natural assets so we know what we have, so we know what we're sacrificing. So, you know, when the decision is made to go ahead with something, then we know what the cost is to going ahead with that. Not just, it was and now it isn't anymore, but there's an actual cost attached to that, whatever that value is for people in the community. And then my last one was innovate, investing in looking at new ways of doing things and taking that risk and relooking at everything we do, and questioning it, I guess, under today's, what we know today, and is there a better way of doing things? So those are pretty high level things, I think. And I don't know what's realistic and what isn't. But, I don't know, does anybody have any comments on any of those items or want to elaborate? David?
Yeah, just sort of combining what you said and what Sharon has said, there are, I know, for instance, the Qualicum Beach Residents Association and so on and so forth, but there are a lot of neighborhoods that don't have a lot of, I think, cohesion in terms of getting together, knowing what's going on in their neighborhood, what your neighbors are thinking and so on and so forth. And whatever we do has a much greater chance of success, either whether it comes from council or it comes from within the community, if there's grassroots involvement and grassroots knowledge. And I think maybe that's something that we ought to be moving toward. Politicians sometimes look askance at this in terms of organizations within the community. You know, but it doesn't have to be a them and us kind of situation. It often is, simply because that's what our system seems to promote. You wait until there is a cause, and then a group of people rally around the cause, and they bring pressure to bear. But I think this needs to be a little more positive. And in a community of this size, that really, with some hard thinking, shouldn't be that difficult a task, I don't think, to try and bring in more community cohesion, encourage more people to become involved, not necessarily working, but at least in terms of their knowledge level. Anyways, that's my rant.
Well, I think that connectedness, too, is really important for community well-being and what your first comments when we were talking about the heat dome, right? Like, if people are connected you know how to connect with people or check up on people or, get people involved, I think it's an important piece. For sure. And I think that, it's beyond what the town is capable of doing. For the most part, we do have those email lists, which are great. And there are other organizations like the community policing. I know they do wellness calls. I do know there's another group, the seniors table, I think through the Oceanside Health and Wellness Network. They're trying to connect with seniors, especially after the heat dome experience. And how do we connect with those isolated people in our community?
Yeah, I think that's one where neighborhood associations or whatever you want to call them become important, because you can easily within your neighborhood, whether it's one block, two blocks, three blocks, four blocks, whatever it is, take note of who's in the neighborhood and get together and work out some kind of a fan-out system in times of where people may come in distress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think our neighborhood was involved with the Crime Watch at one time, and it was really effective for keeping people informed. But it takes somebody to head that up, and unfortunately we lost our volunteers, and so it's kind of gone by the wayside. But I think it's a really good way of keeping your neighborhood connected. And they would do an annual event, and people would get together. I know at the beginning of COVID there were neighborhoods that would go out and socialize because people felt like they weren't getting out otherwise. And maybe we can build on some of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is anybody?
You were mentioning what happened when that kind of cornerstone volunteer disappeared. And it made me think of something that I think about frequently, is that when a system depends on a person and that person goes away, then your system has fallen apart. So, you know, looking a bit further is, you know, how do you set up systems that aren't dependent on personalities, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a little bit more of a challenge, but I think it really speaks to the comments about neighborhood building and community building and having networks. You know, networks are much more resilient than things with only one powerhouse, right? You know, when the power is kind of distributed, when everyone's driving together. So I really like Doug's comments earlier about the, you know, tackling a block and showing how it could be done, right? You know, because potentially it could get people excited, right? And I really like the comments about neighborhood cohesion, right? Because that's ultimately what's going to keep the momentum, right? Mm-hmm. Is that once a number of people are all moving in that direction, then it's harder to stop. Same thing with partnerships. I was talking with my kids about World War I, and I mean, that's the negative side of partnerships, is that, you know, one stupid thing triggered, got multiplied by partnerships, and suddenly the whole world's in a war, right? But partnerships can also hold people together and not just start wars. So when we partner with an organization like, you know, could be anything, could be the Land Conservancy, and that partnership is really hard to break, right? So when we form an outside partnership, you know, it's really hard for the town to back down. Whereas when everything's internal, you know, a future organizational shift, and suddenly you're heading in a different direction. So I know I rambled on a few different topics there, but they all relate to networking, I think, in the fundamental sense.
I think in one of our previous conversations, we did talk, it might have been under the low impact development, we talked about maybe showcasing some great mm-hmm. examples in the community where people have gone over and above. And I think that's a good thing, to focus on the positive and mm-hmm. just even about, like Karen's point, creating that awareness, like that's the conversation you should be having. Look at that place, like look, they did this because of mm-hmm. this. And yeah, because to most people, they wouldn't understand why they went about doing all this, and it didn't look like they really did much, and, you know, like, what's the difference?
Mm.
But there was definitely a conscious effort to make, you know, reduce the runoff and make it more sustainable, efficient. I'm thinking of a house just down the street from where I live.
Mm-hmm.
Karen?
Yeah, and to Luke's point as well, I don't want to keep harping on this Bulk or Creek thing, but one of the things that struck me about that was because Bulk or Creek runs through different municipalities, there was a need for several municipalities as well as grassroots organizations to form the kind of partnership that Luke's talking about. So they got stalled a little bit at one point, and they were able to come out of that impasse because they had commitment in Oak Bay, in Saanich, and in the city of Victoria, as well as this organization that had formed around the creek itself. So there was, it enabled them to sort of form that kind of link, that it wasn't dependent on one municipality, it wasn't dependent on one person, it wasn't dependent on even one organization. It was multi-leveled, and it was, they had all put in the time, and they all felt ownership. So it was key to keeping it going, and it's been going, it's still going now, which is an achievement, right?
And they've had progress along the way that
yeah.
they've been able to show.
Noticeable progress.
Mm-hmm.
that people see and they stop and talk about it. And, you know, then the, one of the things that happened was Oak Bay High School was undergoing a renovation, and they were able to integrate that into the plan for Belker Creek. And now they have classes that go down to the creek and have their lessons right there, because it's running right through the high school property. So it's really impressive.
Which makes me think of KSS, because they're running right through there, too.
There you go.
Yeah. Bob, do you want to jump in?
Well, I hate to point it out, but although there's a great little creek there, it'd be very educational. There's a terrible barrier. The fish passes just on the other side of the village way where the culvert comes up. It's awful. So,
that's a terrible, sorry, I didn't hear that.
Barrier to fish passage. Like the culvert is very elevated and discharges into a pool, causes erosion, but it does not allow for the migration of fish any farther up that system. And it's, we've solved a lot of them in town. That's just one leg of each creek that we haven't done anything about. It's been terribly affected by the multifamily developments that happened right in front of KSS. There's a period of time when it's like it seems very cool.
That's good. So that's a big one to tackle. We won't tackle that today. There's other pressing issues. Okay. Does anybody have any other comments about number 9, about the, or any comments? Doug, you have something to jump in on?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the wording in the climate change adaptation plan was to integrate climate change thinking into our planning, but that's in the context of the climate change adaptation plan. But whenever I read that climate change thinking, I think mitigation as well as adaptation. So I'm hoping that's our interpretation, is that that's what we're aiming for, that we want to integrate climate change mitigation thinking as well as adaptation thinking. And just to emphasize the importance of that point, I'll share with you, I'll send Bernadette this paper, and she can forward it out to all of you. It's a paper by the author Catherine Hayhoe, who wrote a book called Saving Us. She's a climate scientist, and she's the most relentlessly upbeat and optimistic person you could hope to read on the subject of, you know, our future in climate change. She's the opposite of doom and gloom. She recently published an article saying, we cannot adapt our way out of climate change. We are heading for a degree of climate change to which adaptation is impossible, and everything we care about will be swept away. And that is the opinion of, you know, a climate scientist who is a relentlessly optimistic and upbeat person. So I think it's always important to keep in mind when we talk about adaptation that unless we're also talking about mitigation, we're wasting our time for the most part. I mean, not in the short term, of course, you know, whether somebody, adaptation can save lives, for example, in the next heat dome over the next 20 or 30 years. But when we're talking about our children's and grandchildren's lives, we're heading for a degree of climate change to which adaptation will be effectively impossible. So I do hope that as we wrap up our work on the climate change adaptation plan and move into that next phase of work on mitigation, that we find a way to go back to this concept of integrating climate change thinking into everything. And the concrete example is one that Anne mentioned in her brainstorm session there. One was, make it standard that all staff reports would consider climate impacts on really whatever, any subject that staff are reporting on. It would just be a standard thing that there would be a line on, is this in keeping with climate change mitigation and adaptation? So anytime a subdivision is proposed or a new development of any kind is proposed, the climate change mitigation and adaptation would be automatically evaluated as part of the base level evaluation that would necessarily happen. I think that's a feasible thing to do. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that something that could become a standard policy? Maybe Luke and Bob could comment on that.
Sure, I'll comment. My impression is that sometimes when something is required as a matter of practice and it's always included in an agenda, it doesn't have the same impact. I read reports from municipalities where that's in there, and most often they don't have anything to say, or if they have something to say, the evaluation is not very robust. So unless it's very well thought through, I don't necessarily recommend it, right? You know, because otherwise it's just, it's a waste of paper, and wasting paper is not good either. So if you're going to have evaluations, you need to have very clear evaluative criteria and methodology to back up those evaluations. So I do really like the idea in theory, right? Because that, you're right, that's all about climate change thinking embedded into everything. But unless it's done properly, I don't think it should be done.
There are probably some examples out there of communities that are doing that kind of thing. And I always look to Gibson's, right, because they're very progressive. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, we could look at some of those other examples and see what is being done and if it is effective or not, right? And when we talk to them, get their input as to if there's any benefit, if they see the benefit. Yeah. But I think sometimes, looking at what other best practices are is a really good place to start. Under the objective number 9, there was also the report on greenhouse gas energy, community-wide energy consumption and whatnot. And I know it's been a while. But do we have a baseline, or where, do you know, Luke, where our last baseline would be on some of those things? I know the school district has done quite a bit of work on their buildings, and I think they have mm-hmm. three target areas where they look at greenhouse gas emissions.
Sure. Yeah, the last time we did a full set of reporting would have been 2020 on the town's greenhouse gas emissions. So The province is rejigging their current approach to greenhouse gas methodology or accounting and everything. So up until 2020, we were required to report and account and then buy offsets for all of our greenhouse gases. So they're now kind of redoing that whole program. So I don't think we've reported on it since the 2020 year. But it's actually very easy for me. Municipality to do, because we have all of our fuel records, we have all of our vehicular data and utility data. That exercise is very easy, and if everyone in the town was just hand over their utility data, we'd be able to account for it on a community-wide basis as well. But that's the challenge, and we don't have the data to address the community as a whole. But the actual municipality, absolutely, we're all over it.
And yet it must be that the actual emissions from town operations is only a small fraction of emissions from the community as a whole, and energy use for transportation, buildings, effective land use changes, etc. I would think that must dwarf what the actual town operations account for.
Oh yeah, 100%. We're dropping the bucket. You know, if we have 50 vehicles and there's 4,000 in the town, mm-hmm. there's no way we're going to account for a significant fraction.
The town could certainly be a leader. Anne and I had a conversation recently about the potential for the town to invest in some more electric vehicles as the fleet, the operations fleet requires replacement, and I know that the ideal vehicles that the town might want are not available necessarily at an affordable price in electric, but I passed on the information. There's a gardening and landscaping company down in Nanaimo called Acer Landscaping, and they run their business with a white Nissan Leaf, same car I have, with a trailer. And it works fine for them. They go out and they mow people's lawns and do the hedges and all kinds of stuff. And they also advertise that they only use electric lawn equipment, so lawnmowers. And of course, you're not going to go and mow the field with an electric lawnmower, but you could certainly be mowing some of the boulevards. I do see town workers out with just regular sized mowers that could be replaced by some of the higher end battery electric mowers that are now available. So it would be cool to see the town showing leadership in that area. If you know, if you wait for the perfect vehicle and the perfect equipment, that might be a long time, but good is better than waiting for perfect in some ways.
I will note that recently the Public Works had an open house, and I noticed on that tour that there were some electric options as far as lawnmowers and whatnot. So I guess it's on the radar. Bob, did you?
It's certainly on our radar. And the Colgan Beach Memorial Golf Club has started to use quite a few rechargeable devices, so they have various blowers and trimmers and cutters, and we're watching their experience quite closely. They seem to like them so far, but we're comfortable that it's the club's money buying them and experimenting with them, but we're watching the exercise closely because, I mean, we use a lot of this stuff and we use it hard. So we just have to make sure that by the time we, you know, come to council and say this is how we're spending your money, you know, we've got some confidence that we're not just doing it for the show, but they're going to be a practical solution for us that does deliver something else that we're seeking, which is the mitigation climate consideration. So anyway, that's just something we're watching.
Good. Okay. Well, I think it's been a good discussion. There's been a whole number of things that have been brought up. Luke, what would you see as the next steps here?
Well, there's been a lot of really good points made today. I think it's we're going to need to kind of consolidate those into some key points and then record them in the minutes at least, you know, so we can think about them before the next meeting. And, you know, so even if we don't adopt them as one package today, I do think we need to kind of consolidate some key ideas and document them before we forget.
Okay. And with the next meeting, so will we be looking at what recommendations we want to put forward to council? Is that the next step, or?
Yeah, so this is the last objective. So we've covered a lot of ground over the last, you know, six meetings or however many it's been. So we do need to kind of compile those notes, you know, consolidate them into a list of recommendations that could be put forward. So likely that's some homework that needs to be done in preparation of the next meeting. So Bernie and I and Bob will have to put our heads together and see what we can do to consolidate it. Yeah, certainly we're not going to necessarily get it all right, so we'll have to distribute those in advance of the meeting so you have a chance to look back and say, oh, hold on, that's not quite what we said. So I think in preparation of the next meeting, we'll need to look over those minutes, consolidate it, and put it in a format that you can all move forward and potentially vote on in the next meeting.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So the next thing on the agenda was our summer meeting schedule, and I don't know what people's plans are or what your summers look like. There's a list. The next one would be July 11th, August 1st, August 22nd, and September 12th were the dates that were put forward. I personally, I know the August 1st one is not going to work for me.
No.
That's right near the long weekend, I believe.
It is the Monday, the holiday Monday, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
So my preference would be not to be
yeah.
at that time. But I didn't know at the July 11th if people would be available.
I am.
You are?
But it's worse.
Okay.
Looks like most people.
Is it possible to join by phone? I tend to be on Mosquito Island, don't have much of an internet connection, but can I use a cell phone to join into one of these meetings? Does that work?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll go ahead then with the July 11th. Is that going to be enough time, Luke, for compiling that information? Or?
We'll do our best.
Okay.
And even if we only make it through one section or a few sections, then we can make some progress with that meeting.
Yeah, we can divide it up if we have to.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. And then August 22nd, does that date work?
Yep.
Okay. So we'll go with that, and then we can look at September 12th later. That should be okay because we're back to kind of normal. Do those dates work for staff as well, Luke? Do you know?
Yes, I'm. As far as I know, I'm available.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, so the only other thing I was going to mention is that I know the Qualicum Beach Residents Association is hosting a climate change event on Saturday. It's prior the head of their AGM. So at 1:30, it's going to be held in the Civic Center. And they have, I believe, the Fridays for the Future students are going to be making a presentation. They have the poster in front of me. But also somebody from VIU is making, let me just see if I can bring it up. Okay, so how Vancouver Island municipalities, communities, and individuals are essential to meaningful solutions. So bring your questions, your passion, and your determination to be part of the solution. So there's a presentation, the climate emergency and the role municipalities must play, and that's by the high school students of Fridays for the Future. And then the 2021 heat dome, impacts, causes, actions, that's a VIU awareness of climate change through education and research. There's two students that will be speaking to that. And the third one is food security questions for Qualicum Beach, and that's going to be hosted by Graham Riches. So if anybody can make it, I would suggest it might be of interest to the members of this committee. And then there'll be a break, and then there'll be the AGM. So you don't have to stick around for the AGM. You can just come for the climate conversation if you're interested. And I think that is it. Future agenda items and discussion? Nothing. I think there's a couple of things on our agenda that were referred from council. I was just going to suggest maybe Luke or Bernadette, when it comes back to item B about the climate emergency declaration, there was a staff report. Could that perhaps be circulated to the committee so that they know what council was referring?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Great.
So if that would likely be at the August or September meeting, depending on how things track in the next meeting or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay, great. Just if there could be a note that when it comes forward for consideration, the staff memo, I think, would be helpful. And that's it. Unless anybody last chance to add anything or any comments or nope. Okay, so meeting for adjournment. Our motion, sorry, for adjournment, sorry, Doug and Greg. The meeting is adjourned.